another laptop.
Howdy. I'm John Apolito, Associate Curator of Media Arts here at the Guggenheim, and I want to welcome you to Who Controls New Media? Open Art in Closed Systems, a discussion co-sponsored and organized by the Goethe Institute. 10 years ago, the rich tapestry of interwoven communities and creative practices we call digital culture didn't exist. 10 years from now, it may again cease to exist. Not because of stock market crashes or terrorist attacks, but because of our inability to find the exact balance of chaos and regulation that gave rise to the internet in the first place. Now, the intellectual property debate is usually framed as a conflict between the interests of artists, creative people, and the interests of the public. Take away patents, and programmers may have no incentive to program. Take away copyright, filmmakers may not film, dancers won't dance. The funny thing, though, is that policymakers rarely bother to ask the actual creators how they feel about legal systems designed to protect them. Maybe it's because judges and senators usually rely on expert testimony, and it's hard to find an expert on starving artists by looking in the Yellow Pages. Whatever the reason, the testimony that usually makes it into the docket, intellectual property briefs from movie industry lawyers or cameo depositions by Metallica drummers, are about as far away from the perspective of the struggling artist as you can get. For example, I recently attended this summit called Art, Technology, and Intellectual Property. It was a very well-meaning, but a very misleading title. At this conference, ex-NEA chieftains rub shoulders with registrars from the U.S. Copyright Office and vice presidents for the Motion Picture Association of America hobnob with their counterparts from the recording industry. But among all of these 60 assembled lobbyists and lawyers, there was only one practicing non-commercial artist. Yours truly. I should also say that there was only one technologist. This is, again, a conference called Art, Technology, and Intellectual Property. Well, if you add up all of the various perspectives and just think about whose perspective is going to win the lion's share of the recommendations that get sent to Congress, it's not hard to do the math and figure out that artists are the ones getting the bad end of the stick. Well, the purpose of tonight's discussion is to try to correct that imbalance by breathing a fresh perspective on art and artists into the hitherto musty chambers of juridical proceedings. To do that, we've assembled a panel of remarkable people. These are people who know at least as much about Nam June Paik and hard drives as they do about nolo contendere and habeas corpus. We've got Dieter Daniels on stage on the right, a professor of art history and media theory at Leipzig's Academy of Visual Arts. He organized Leipzig's multimedia biennale, Minimum Media. He co-founded the Videonale in Bonn, he headed the media tech at ZKM, and he's been the editor with Rudolf Rehling of two books and CD-ROMs produced by ZKM and the Goethe Institute. They are called Media Art Action and Media Art Interaction. We'll be drawing on this historical audiovisual material during our actual presentation. Next to him is Alex Galloway. He's an artist, computer programmer, and director of content and technology. That's quite a combination, at Rhizome.org, a leading platform for online and new media art. His first book, Protocol, or How Control Exists After Decentralization, will appear next year from MIT Press. Next to him is Wendy Seltzer, an intellectual property lawyer and open source computer programmer. Now, I never thought I'd use those two terms together to describe one person. The intersection of those two sets, intellectual property and open source programming, must be zero. But in fact, it is one. It is Wendy Seltzer. And we have her here. She's a fellow with Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. In collaboration with Stanford Law Professor Lawrence Lessig and others, she's launching three new projects designed to preserve the public domain. We're going to look at those today. So first, I'd like to thank Goethe Institute for helping to organize the event, and mention a couple other upcoming educational events at the Guggenheim. April 9th, Collecting the Uncollectible, a roundtable on business models for collecting art in digital media. That was April 9th. May 6th, an interactive multi-user art screening by Mark Napier, and we'll mention his work again later in the conference. And May 15th, Coding as Creative Writing, John Simon demonstrating the infinite possibilities of programming. You can find all this stuff at www.guggenheim.org if your hand wasn't fast enough to write it down today. Okay, with that introduction, I'm going to start right into the discussion, and we'll go on for a little bit. We're going to talk about the present moment, the historical roots of the present moment, some definitions of what it means to be open art, for example, some solutions to the problem, and end with hopefully some questions from the audience. Okay, so what combination of factors makes this a critical juncture for creativity in society? And Wendy, I'm going to throw the question first to you.
Well, what's so exciting about the internet is the way it expands people's ability to communicate, expands the number of people who can be publishers and create and share their creations with more than just a small circle of friends. And at the same time they do that creating, they often attract the attention of lawyers concerned that their creations are infringing someone else's intellectual property rights. And I'm sure my fellow panelists can say much more than I about the way art relies on its predecessors, the way artists draw upon earlier works and reuse those works in creating new works. What I can bring as a lawyer is the way the law sees that, and it's not always as artistic reuse, but as unauthorized derivative works or copyright infringement. And there are several recent court cases where the law and not artists are determining what will be permitted in the visual arts and literature. For example, Two Live Crew did a rap version of Roy Orbison's Oh Pretty Woman, changed the lyrics, used a bit of the melody, and added their own beats and completely changed the meaning of the song to their Pretty Woman, had to go all the way up to the Supreme Court to determine that that was a fair use of the earlier work.
What about something like The Wind Done Gone? That was another famous case.
Just recently, that's right. Alice Randall wanted to produce a parody or sequel to Gone with the Wind, retold not from the perspective of the Southern Belle, but from Scarlett's slave half-sister, who would be critical of the plantation owners and give her own perspective on the antebellum South. Margaret Mitchell's estate sued, saying this was an unauthorized sequel, a copyright infringement in retelling scenes that Mitchell had made famous. Randall was stealing from the Mitchell estate, the lawyers claimed. And the trial court believed this slapped an injunction against publication of The Wind Done Gone. And on appeal, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals recognized the tremendous First Amendment value of this work of criticism and literary work and said that the First Amendment demanded that it be allowed to be published. We couldn't slap a prior restraint against publication.
Okay, so we have some court cases where the court is arguing in favor of fair use. How about cases where there may not have been a clear court ruling, where the work may have been more, the status was less clear, or rather, let me put it a different way. Those are examples from somewhat older media in the sense of electronic, recorded music and printed books. How about the internet? How about the internet itself? Have there been comparable cases of where artistic endeavors have been endangered online? Alex, do you?
Well, one of the, I guess, most prominent examples from the world of net art is a case that came into the public eye, I guess, in the winter of 1999 into 2000 involving the art group eToy, where there was a conflict between the online toy seller eToys.com and the art group eToy, and the art group was sued by the online retailer simply because of the similarity between the two names. And this became a sort of, I think a lot of people within the art community and the internet community at large realized that this was sort of a clear-cut case because the artists had been using the name several years prior, and you know, on top of the fact that the difference between an art site and a website and an e-commerce site, just one letter difference, you know, what really constitutes the infringement there. And then subsequently, the art group staged a sort of reactive art project, a participatory game called Toy War, which was to sort of narrativize this relationship between the suing party and the recipients of that suit,
which we're going to get into a little bit later.
Yeah.
Okay, so clearly we have these cases where the sort of, you know, the conventional interests as represented by the intellectual property law are banging up against artists who want to try new forms of expression, and also the interests of the previous artists or their estates or representatives who are trying to somehow keep their work from being what they perceive to be slandered or changed or critiqued. How do we get into this mess? Like, where did this sort of technological, problem emerge? Dieter, what's your perspective on this?
Yeah, John, you're so friendly to introduce me as an art historian, which is true from my formation. But if you allow, I will say a few words about technology, too, because the history of technology is the other side of media art, which is often ignored by the art perspective, I think. And if we want to talk about aspects of openness, I think the question how open any kind of media use, including artists, including normal use, including commercial use, how open that can be is often depending on the structure of the technology itself. And so if you permit, I want to go way, way back to the real beginnings of some network ideas in the early 20th century, that I can have a slide. See, I just push it. No, that's too far. This is a blank. So I have to show you a preview. Sorry, we are on the wrong end. But that doesn't matter. No. So what I'm going to show you is something where you won't believe when I tell you the date, because the moment you see it, you will
there we go.
You will immediately believe that this is a sketch of the internet in this early stage. But it is, in fact, a sketch of 1916, yes? 1916, so believe it. And it was a proposal that wasn't realized at the time. It is a proposal by the so-called American Radio Relay League, which was a completely independent, not government-controlled, not commercial group of amateurs who made ham radio. And naturally, their radio transmissions had a limited reach. And so they developed the idea to have, with their friends, forward messages across the U.S. So you could forward a message from coast to coast, even though the single ham operator didn't reach that far. So if you compare that to the 1990 sketch of the internet in its early, in its early stage, the inter-university net, this looks pretty much the same. And you see the idea of an open network, which was at the early stages of the internet, the driving force, before the breakthrough of commercialization, is something that was in the air already at the early 20th century.
Early in the air.
Early in the air, yeah. And it wasn't realized at the time for a simple reason, that the proposal by the American Radio Relay League was given to the government in case that America would decide to enter World War I. And so at that moment, they were clearly facing the first possibility that foreign troops would invade America. And because the technology was so far that ships could travel and airplanes could fly, so they were fearing a communication breakdown already in 1916. And the amateurs were proposing this distributed network where if you destroy one point, you still get the message around the other one. And this is the basic idea of the ARPANET, which was a forerunner of the Internet in the 1960s. So, sorry for these technological details, but I want to say that history sometimes tends to repeat itself. And that we always believe that technology is on the front of progress. But if you go into research and if you look at how technology is developed and how ideas and ideologies for technologies develop, sometimes you find in different places, in different times, this idea of a completely open structure, which then, due to reasons we still are going to talk about, is going to be closed down. And I think that is what we are witnessing with the Internet now. And I'm going to have more examples, if you want, later on, comparing the Internet situation of the 90s with the communication situation of the radio boom, which came after. I'll just show you one slide. Can I show one more?
Yeah,
okay. I always get the wrong button, you know. This technology is just too complicated for me. For example, here you have a transition moment in the history of electronic media. Because radio was the first electronic medium you had at home, except the telephone, which wasn't so much a medium, but this was the first mass medium, which people still in the early days built themselves. So you didn't buy a radio, you bought just the parts to assemble it, you know, and you did it yourself. And you had to be a tech freak to have a radio. And radio at the early stage was really a communication apparatus. It was not something to listen to, but it was something to communicate through with Morse code. And to link to what Wendy said, before 1912, there was no legal regulation of who could be on the air. Yeah, it was complete anarchy. Imagine that, you know, today, where each kind of wavelength is strictly limited and there's very precise, it's like real estate, what is on the air. And before 1912, there was no legal occupation at all. And this is a little bit later, this is 1922, but you see this guy is using his equipment to do communication, Morse code, and the family comes in and they want to listen to concerts. Because at the same time, broadcasters start to broadcast music, and song and speech. So you have to transition from an open communication structure to a broadcast consumption structure, so to say. So it's getting from an interactive thing to a passive listener thing. And it's a kind of family conflict which you see here, which is kind of symbolic for the moment in media history.
Right.
And I will refer later on when we talk about Brecht, maybe about that. And just to show you that the economic boom already was promised. I always get the wrong button. Anyway, the economic boom was already promised then. So this was a promise of how radio sales would develop after the broadcasting, the controlled broadcasting was through, and after the frequencies were more and more occupied by the industry, and they were pushing hard to sell their equipment. So this was the kind of new economy of the late 1920s, which naturally ended with the stock market crash of 1929. And I think we just had that recently.
Well, there's a set of parallels to the present day.
Yeah.
Interestingly, something that's not so much parallel as the exact same situation. We learned today from our theater director at the Guggenheim, Mike Lavin, that this relay league still exists. And in fact, they are occasionally called upon to do government errands like get 500 cc's of O negative blood to demute. So it's interesting that there's actually that still exists. But one of the things that I'd like to focus on now is how the present day mirrors that situation. We have a lot of parallels, Wendy.
Yeah, I find these cartoons fascinating because they could almost be updating the technology a bit. They could be describing the situation we have today. The early Internet was the province of the computer scientists who were using it for email, for news groups, for interactive communication. This was all two-way. It was talking to one another. And what we're hearing now is that instead of this communication, in order to get broadband rolled out to the public, we need to return to a broadcast model where we protect the intellectual property so that the movie studios will feel comfortable sending their blockbuster movies out over the internet. But to do that, they're asking for protections that would cripple the one-to-one or the peer-to-peer communications that were so key to the early internet. And we're just starting to hear debate over which kind of internet do we want to have.
What are some of the proposals that have been made to encourage a more, a structured system or a controlled system or a broadcast model?
Well, a couple of pieces of legislation. One already passed, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, sets up some fences around digital content and says that anyone who has put an access control or copy control on media, it is unlawful to circumvent that control, so that DVDs, for example, are produced in an encrypted form, and people who want to use those DVDs to make for film criticism aren't able to take an excerpt and use it in their own product. They're stuck instead using the disc as it came from the movie studio, including as it came with advertisements and warnings that they can't fast forward through at the beginning, and are technologically and legally, by this combination of the two, forbidden from making it into their own communicative product.
So actually in with DVDs, we sort of have less interactivity or versatility than we had with CDs or even VHS tapes.
Where that's
you can
right.
At least fast forward past the commercials if you want to. Yeah, that's fascinating.
And then another initiative that's just now being talked about by Senator Hollings, the Secure Systems Standard Certification Act, which is something the record studios and movie studios have pressed for, that would essentially require every personal computer and every device that was capable of playing media to be hardwired to recognize copy controls in that media and to shut down if it saw unauthorized content. So instead of this general purpose computer here that I can essentially program to do anything I want, I would get a glorified DVD player that when it saw something that didn't look like an official Hollywood product, would simply refuse to play it out of the fear that I had pirated the movie.
And the presumption of protection of artists there would be that, you know, if I created something and it went out into the world digitally, of course it's infinitely copyable. And if I want people to pay for my product, this computer would essentially sniff out pirated versions of that product.
That's right. But the problem with the way this technology works is that anything that you can hear, you can copy. Anything you can see, you can copy. But even if it's a slightly lower quality copy, you put a microphone outside the speaker and you're going to get a recording of the music that was coming out of it. So unless every device is listening for watermarks, those copies are going to get out there. And in trying to plug every hole, we end up with devices that can't play music. If I recorded music myself that didn't have the right watermarks, I might find myself unable to copy it. Mini disc players have some of the copy controls now, and people are finding that when they record their own music onto a mini disc, because it's a nice, convenient little piece of technology, they are prohibited from making copies on consumer technology.
It strikes me that a lot of the intellectual property issues in the past have revolved around freedom of expression, but it seems that this has to do much more with consumption. So would you say that freedom of consumption is sort of the more pressing issue right now for a lot of people?
Well, part of it is freedom of consumption, but consumption in a way that enables the people to reuse it in their own expression.
But there's that, but it's even a step before that, right? Because if you wanted to write your own DVD player, you couldn't. Just to watch a DVD, you'd have to use a licensed DVD player.
That's right.
Let's kind of look at the flip side of the coin here. We've been talking about the kind of technology, the roots of openness and how things got closed with in the radio boom and later technologies, both on the political side and the technological side. How about the roots of art here? I mean, we've had this historical zigzag between opened and closed. What's happened to art during this period?
Yeah. I first want to add a very banal experience I made here in New York the last 2 days in my hotel room, which absolutely confirms of what you guys said. That I have in my hotel room, I have a TV set, and I have a wireless keyboard, where you said you can access the internet from here. I went downstairs and said, okay, if I want to access the internet, what do I have to do? You have to pay $10 for 12 hours, but you can only browse and you can do no email. So it is transformed actually into a broadcast medium by this hotel situation. You know, so this is the transition of what we have been seeing in the 1920s from a kind of communication medium to a passive consumption medium. And artists, I think, Alex, you will show some works how artists today react upon that and try to keep the communicative and so-called emancipative power. You will talk about that too, maybe, that some media theorists imagined to keep that going or to be subversive or to keep small areas of freedom. But that also is an idea that came up, as you asked, in the 1920s already. And, for example, the German writer Bertolt Brecht, mostly known for his theater pieces and for his prose, did some experiences in the field of radio, and he made a proposal to change the radio medium into a communicative situation during his so-called Hörspiel, which is an audio play performed for the radio. And he wanted to have the listeners at home to have the text and to sing with the radio. So to be not only passive, even if they don't have sending devices themselves, but at least to have not just consumption, but to have an active participation in the creation of the artwork. So that is not technology-based, but it's more conceptually based. And radio naturally, at the time in 1930, wasn't able to do that. They weren't able to distribute the sheets to the people, and they were kind of refusing his proposals. So what he did, he set it up on stage as a kind of model. So on the left, you have the sign saying the radio, and on the right, you have somebody who is listening, who says the listener is signed. And he is performing that what Brecht was expecting to do the audience at home, to be an active participating audience, which is the same way he wanted to be his theater experiences. He tried to avoid in his theater pieces the 19th century black hole that you had, and he wanted to go back to the interactive theater of the Italian tradition, which you might know from your roots, I don't know, but and where people really shout and get involved and where it's a kind of collective experience.
What's interesting about this is that it's not exactly a technological intervention. In fact, he couldn't really change the technology underlying it. It was more like an emblematic presentation that suggested what the technology was capable of, even if it wasn't currently used that way.
I just read a small quote by a speech he gave in front of the radio executive committee, where he was allowed as the only artist. So he had the same experience as you have. And he said, change this apparatus, the radio, over from distribution to communication. You have to submit constant, incessant suggestions for improving the usage of the apparatus for the general good. And we have to rock the social foundations of this apparatus to discuss how it is being used to further the interest of the few. So he wanted it to become a real mass collective experience and naturally a political and social instrument. He was basically a Marxist at the time, so he wanted this to be a kind of revolutionary program that would be possible by this collective experiences, you know.
so I think we know that song too. So, but
so that was the story with, you know, radio, but there's been other, you know, technologies since, and how have artists evolved in their approach to other technology they felt could be opened up?
Yeah, let me stick a moment to radio and show you one more slide about radio stuff, and then we can go on to TV maybe. I always give a kind of review, preview. So this is a piece for audio tape by John Cage, where you had random musical parts of different sounds collected on 8 tracks. And it's just a 4-minute piece, but it took him in analog times, I think, like 7 months to glue them all together with the help of some friends. Something you would do today very quickly. And similar concepts and proposals he also did for radio, in the sense that his Imaginary Landscape number 4 from 1951 was a piece where you had 12 radios and 24 performers. And it just consists in the sounds of what is on the air. There are no pre-recordings, nothing that is predefined. So naturally, if you did it 1951 in the US, it was completely different than what is on the air today or in a different place of the world. And each performer plays, so to say, like an instrument with the two radios according to a score defined by random operations derived from the E-game. So you see that he tries to reintroduce openness on the part of the listener. He wants to re-enable us openness in approaching the mass medium. He doesn't want us to listen to the program, he wants us to listen to the medium. And he wants us to have the experience that we are always surrounded by lots of information that are in the air and that's getting more and more, which is cell phone and everything else. We kind of have an overload of information in the air already, kind of pollution already. But here is more a kind of resensitivity of getting off the broadcast straightforward experience into a kind of creative listening. So 20 years after Brecht, he kind of canceled the illusion of changing the whole broadcast system. He said that won't work. You won't change as an artist. You're a kind of single player. You're a lonely gorilla, and you won't have a chance to cancel the whole system. But you can develop new situations for receiving, for listening, and you can enable people to get these happy new ears that was Cage talking about. So I think this is the first step of being open. Yes, being open from a kind of receptive situation. And later on we can see how artists try to develop open structures in the technology itself. Yeah, but that will be later on when we talk about interactivity and things like that.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the interventions made in television, Namjoon Paik?
I don't want to take too much time at this place, but...
How about a quick...
Should we go on to television at the moment? Okay.
Reference.
And then we need to say to Ram now.
Okay.
And,
yeah, it's... I'll switch over. Do you want to cut the slide, please?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a blank. Let me see. He proposed me... Oh, yo. How can I always get in the wrong direction? It's so... So this is a blank that was proposed. And now we can switch on the CD-ROM.
There we go.
Okay.
Yeah. So just click on the back.
Just click on the back. So this is actually the CD-ROM that was produced by the generosity of the Goethe Institute, and that you have a book stand outside, which, if you're interested, you can have a look at that. It's sold together with a book, so this was the ad. Like in TV, you have a short promo break, so now we go on.
We'll be skipping over that in the list.
Okay, you're skipping over that on the page. Yeah. Okay. So where is the interaction here? I mean, there's lots of stuff on this one, and I just
maybe you can show a very brief,
very
like
brief.
A stereo one. Yeah, that's great.
So you saw the score of Cage for tape, for audio tape, and this was a score for a 4-minute piece, which it took him, as I said, 7 months of gluing. And this is a contribution by Namjoon Paik. It is. Well, almost 10 years later, and which is much more open in the general structure and also in the technological approach, as he's gluing the tape on the wall and no longer making a predefined composition of, let's say, 4 minutes, but you have to be the player of the piece yourself. So
So there is no predefined piece any longer unless you are the one who uses it. So you get not only a listener, but you get a user, so to use some technology that is very current today. So he opened the audio equipment and took out the
playback head.
The playback head, and he put it on a long cord. So it's no longer sitting in the machine and the tape is running around it, but you have it in your hand, and you can follow the tape with your hand and listen to the sounds which are glued on the wall here. Yeah? So he made from a kind of linear instrument, he made an interactive, non-linear, open instrument.
And the title of this work, some of you may remember it from our retrospective a year ago, or 2 years ago, is Random Access, and the date is 1963.
It was in the show, in the Good Time show here.
It was interactive.
And he did the same for vinyl discs, where you have the needle in your hand and you could scratch around.
Vinyl discs, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this is very interesting. I mean, this is 1963, and if you think about techno DJ, what does he do today? I mean, he uses the vinyl disc as an instrument. So an instrument of reproduction is becoming an instrument of creation. This is why we still have vinyl disc. Otherwise, we wouldn't have CDs. Nobody would buy any vinyl disc anymore. But he wants, DJ wants this kind of access to technology, which is physical, which you don't have on CDs. So this is really prefiguring avant-garde events and prefiguring mass culture of today, in a way. So this computer is scheduled to shut down at 8 o'clock.
That was the SSCA.
That's right. It's telling you that you won't be able to do that on a DVD. In the next generation.
You want to look at some of the exposition music, a quick
the TV piece. Okay, we have a TV piece too.
We're moving now from the technology of audio, the early part of the 20th century, to the technology of TV at the mid-century.
It's part of the same show that the audio pieces by Cage were in, that he did his first TV experimentations. And these TV experimentations look pretty kind of shabby today. It was, as I said, in an early stage. It was before video. Video only came in 1965, so it's not video art, it's TV art. And TV art was there before that. And he really went into the technology, so he became a kind of amateur, you know. He really was kind of unscrewing it and rewiring sets, only used equipment because he had no money at the time, and making TV interactive. That was his interest. He called it participation TV, but it was taking place as the Cage pieces in a kind of receiver situation. He didn't change the whole TV system. He wasn't able to do that. It was in a private gallery. But it was meant as a model for the future of television that will be interactive, according to Pike. And that's 30 years ago, when you had only one single TV channel in Germany. You couldn't even be zapping, you know. I forgot to say with Cage that naturally this listening thing is something that prefigures zapping. So you also have the avant-garde
surfing,
channel surfing, the avant-garde invention that prefigures mass media use today. So and here he had a lot of kind of different images that he was able to create, always using the current broadcast program. This was the only image source.
He was basically either tweaking the wires or adding magnets or things onto the.
Or you had a microphone. If you made sounds in the microphone, these would interfere with the image, you know. And we had all kinds of stuff, you know. So there's even a drawing in that somewhere, but we lost the drawing somehow.
Right.
You want to see the drawing? I think we're fine. Yeah. Well, let's. Oh, here it comes. The drawing.
Okay.
The drawing by Pike, where he shows how they were all changed. You know, this is negative one, this is rolling, this is with a foos compact, so you had to push a button. With
what, it was operated. This is before the mouse.
Exactly.
Okay, well, you know, this is an excellent sort of background to the evolution of artists attempting to create openness against what technological paradigms that became closed, whatever reason, political or economic.
But this time also the other way around, of prefiguring a possible future openness with a very primitive technological means and of saying it's not the only way we can do it, of having one TV channel and that the TV is either on or off. So this is like in church.
Yeah.
Whether you go in or you go out. And that's not what TV is all about today. So he was kind of imagining that there would be some other use of TV, which in a way happened, but not the way he imagined, you know. So it's utopian, but the utopia didn't fulfill that artist's hope, you know. So that happened to net art in some aspects.
So we have this sort of tradition of openness, of art made in an open way, and we also have openings and closings of technology and of the law, of the legal constraints on artists and technologists. Let's try to sort of tease apart these different definitions, because we're, you know, the subtitle of this conference is Open Art and Closed Systems. What do we mean by openness? There's different kind of uses of the term. Dieter, we've sort of been just come from artwork. What is an open artwork? How would you define that, or how has it been historically defined?
I hate definitions, you know.
How's it been characterized?
Well, I'm getting academic. It's a book by Umberto Eco from 1963 called The Open Artwork. So this is definitely where it comes from, you know. And it's Umberto Eco. It's the one who wrote in the El Nome de la Rosa, in English.
The name of the rose.
Okay. So he's not only a linear fiction writer for consumption, which was even put into a Hollywood movie, but in his early days he had the idea of this open artwork as a kind of semiotic experience. He took some impulses from contemporary music, which he saw as an open structure, and tried to build a theory of that. And he also adapted it to film and even to live television at the time, in the early 60s. And he said that an open artwork for him is not yet an interactive work, that we can show some examples later on, but it's more something in the Cagean sense, where you don't know what's going to happen next, so which is not predefined. So this would be maybe the first and simplest definition or the condition of any openness, if it's not predefined. So if it's already defined, there's no openness left. So, and maybe in the second step, from being not predefined, it's a possibility of participating in how it develops, you know. This was not so much in Eco's work, but in contemporary artists' work, because the book by Eco was published almost the same year as the show by Pike, although they didn't know about each other. So you see that theory and artist praxis is running on a parallel track, and they are kind of interrelated now by people like us, and they didn't know about each other at the time. And from then on, you come to the whole question of interactivity, which we will raise later on, I think.
Okay, do you want to give an example of one of the works that was, say, performance from the period?
You mean something participative?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just making a solo here, but okay, if you want, I can show one work which is not media-based, but interactive in a very interesting sense. And then it's up to you, to my colleagues. Oops. It's just too speedy here. Okay. So this is the one. It is a street performance by the Austrian media and performance artist Wally Export, who in 1968, naturally it's the time of street actions, when many other people were on the street too, was doing this in front of pornographic cinemas, which became trendy at the time. And she wanted to show that just the consumption of pornographic movies is just increasing the frustration. And she says something like, as long as we have commercial pornography, the real sexual revolution is avoided. You know, this is her kind of argument for her action, which we will see now in some excerpts. And the guy with the loudspeaker is Peter Weibel, by the way.
Peter Weibel is...
Maybe we don't see it.
But you can describe it fairly...
Shit, it's such a pity. It's such a thing. There's no quick time on that machine. We didn't try the videos before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, the Jeffrey Shaw one worked. But...
Yeah, the other one worked. Okay.
Well, I think you can describe it.
Well, okay, she's wearing a box around her chest, and she's inviting people to, it's closed, and it has a small kind of curtain in the front, which is the cinema entrance, and she's inviting people to put in the hands for a limited time, which is the length of the film, and to touch her breast, which is nude under that.
So it's clear that the sensors got into the machine here.
Yeah. And it's called Cabin Touch Cinema, you know, and he's just shouting and provoking people to come along and do it.
for their requisite.
And to get the real experience instead of the fake experience which you get in the cinema, you know.
So interactivity is personal.
And it's interactive without technology, you know. It's talking about media, but it doesn't use them, you know. I'm still going to play that in the end. I'm going to install that.
We'll install it while we're looking at something else.
Okay.
But in the meantime, let's shift gears a little bit here. Okay, so we have this tradition, of, or at least this parallel currents, that we might call the open artwork, in Umberto Eco's term. We also now have a kind of update to the 1990s, again, fast forwarding, the open source programming paradigm. Many of you may have heard of open source. Alex, what is it?
Open source just means that the code, the actual computer, the actual lines of computer code that were used to create the software are available to read and perhaps modify. Why is this important? Well, for those of you who aren't computer programmers, a little background. The process of programming is sort of an abstract process. Where you create a sort of set of instructions, which are these lines of computer code, which aren't really the ultimate product that you want, unless you are perhaps like John Simon, a poet when it comes to coding itself. What you want, right, is the execution of that software. You want somebody to run it later. So it's this sort of abstracted process where you make something, which is what you're focusing on, but the product is sort of delayed and later. So when you get a piece of software, you're not getting necessarily the original code, the source code. You're getting the product. So that's really why open source is important, because based on what technology is being used, it's easier or less easier to actually obtain the source code, to figure out how it works.
If I were to throw out a metaphor here, could you say that it's kind of analogous to buying a toy like a car versus buying Legos with instructions to build a car? Like, if you bought a car that was made of Legos, you could play with it and add wheels or wings or whatever you want.
That's a good example. Another example is the difference between buying, let's say, going to a bakery and buying a loaf of bread versus buying a loaf of bread and having the recipe on the bag.
Yeah.
There's this great a quote from Richard Stallman, this sort of guru of free software, and I hope I can paraphrase it correctly, where he says that sharing code is as old as computer programming, just in the same way that sharing recipes is as old as cooking. So there's this kind of process where you have a set of instructions or a recipe that allows you to create the final product, and so the kind of personal question is, you know, do you give the person the final product, or do you give them also the original set of instructions, the information on how to make that product themselves, how to tweak it, maybe make something else, you know, maybe you want to change the recipe,
less salty,
learn from it,
right? Put raisins in. That's a very good analogy. So we've looked at openness in the context of art, in the context of programming. Now let's look at the context of law. When you get the hardest question, what's the difference between open source and open license?
Well, let me just step back very briefly. Open source has parallels in the law outside. It's a very democratic way of programming. Open source gives programmers the tools to rewrite the programs that are governing their actions on the computer and write the rules that their programs will and their user actions will live by. So open source and free software got its real start with Richard Stallman, whose genius idea was the new general public license, which is also known as the copyleft, which goes one step beyond just open source. And it says you get the source with this program. You can do whatever you want with the program. You can recompile it, modify it to do whatever you want the program to do, on the condition that when you give the program to someone else, you give them the same freedom that you got by giving them the source code to your modified program. And the GPL does this by relying on copyright, which says only the author and copyright holder can authorize the distribution and the creation of derivative works, these exclusive rights of the copyright holder. The GPL says it's a license, a legal document that says the copyright owner gives you the right to modify and reproduce so long as you give away the same freedoms that you got.
And because of that, it's been characterized as having a sort of viral quality, because all of the derivative projects or anything that you mentioned that are sort of chronologically downstream also have to use the same legal document. So they're sort of, if you will, infected by this original
right.
sense of freedom. So it uses the strength of intellectual property law sort of
mm-hmm.
not to undo it, but to take it in a different direction.
So it sort of inherits an open gene.
Yeah.
Openness becomes the property of all of the children of that gene. To go back to the more offline or analog analogies, it would be as though you could sell this toy with Legos and people could remake new toys, add new parts and so on, but they couldn't glue it together. Or you could use a recipe to make something, but you could never not distribute your new bread
right.
if its own recipe. You always have to keep it as open as the license requires.
Right.
Well,
because of this participatory nature, because of the way people contribute to free software projects, they tend considerable review of the code, and often very good programs come out of open source and free software programming that help to propagate those ideas. People realize that they've gotten the Linux kernel that does nearly everything they want. They should use that rather than reinvent software that doesn't serve their needs.
So by virtue of being sort of put out in the public domain and vetted by a large number of people rather than a small sort of staff programmers, then it has the possibility for becoming better code. That's the argument.
Right. Let me just throw out a question then. Okay, we've got these various definitions of open.
John, there are some questions in the
audience. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
I see someone vigorously
waving
their hand.
Okay, well, I guess we should pick on the vigorous hand waver. Yeah. So the question is, let me make sure I understood, because I don't think I understand correctly.
The question is, you're giving your code to somebody, you're developing developers and something else, and they can develop an application that's patented.
Mm-hmm.
They might as well figure out if somebody's taking their idea further. So what's the chance that they're going to let them do whatever they're going to do, or is it hard for them to become part of Microsoft?
Okay, so is the presumption that Microsoft would be distributing things on an open source license, or no?
No. He decided, Bill was my friend, and decided to say, okay, open source.
I see.
So he sees somebody developing his idea. Here's a question. Is he going to let you do it on his own and patent it and make money versus I'm going to hire you, you want your idea, and blah, blah, whatever?
There's just two different... yeah. You're bringing up two very different sort of philosophies of how... different cultural products can be created. One is a proprietary model where you have a sort of staff set of creative people, right? Programmers in Redmond. Right. Yeah, I mean that's a difficult question. If that person doesn't first, get a cease and desist letter, then maybe they'll be brought back into the fold. So it's difficult. I don't know. Probably hire him. I mean, that's a trend right now is to take these sort of outsider creative types like hackers and bring them back into hire them on as systems administrators and programmers.
One other thing we should say is that open source isn't a contract between one person and another person. It is a license in which it's distributed to anyone. So anyone else who happened to get this code
like you could they could hire that guy and have him work for Microsoft, but anyone else in the world who had got the code would still be legally.
We don't know what Bill Gates' mind is about.
There are some people who won't be swayed by if Microsoft's millions.
Don't make that much money, so if we knew what
I can assure you, Richard Stallman is not going to go work for Microsoft, no matter how much.
Anyone who has vigorous questions, the higher you wave, the more we'll be able to see you. But, yeah. We're looking forward to a vigorous debate with the audience. But the beginning of this is going to be more like the SSSCA version where you're not allowed to interact with us that much. But yes, let's get into that soon. I'd like to jump, just for time reasons, to comparing these different senses of openness. We talked about art, the open artwork. We talked about programming, the open source. We talked about law, the open license. I'd like to start with a quote here, which I think really brings this connection together and makes it more than a purely superficial resemblance. Namjoon Paik, 1969. John Cage, 1969. Computers are bringing about a situation that's like the invention of harmony. Subroutines are like chords. No one would think of keeping a chord to himself. You'd give it to anyone who wanted it. You'd welcome alterations of it. Subroutines are altered by a single punch. That was back with punch cards. We're getting music made by man himself, not just one man. And again, that's John Cage speaking. I mean, I don't know where the genesis of open source is. I assume it's Richard Stallman in the early 80s, but it's amazing to see this.
Yeah, but it's a gorgeous quote you found. It brings the different tracks we had together, and that he's really talking about computers at the time as something that is the place where the human interaction, which he wants, you know, he's not interested in technology at all, John Cage. He's a kind of anti-technologist in a way, you know. But he sees that technology is the place where a kind of new communication structure can be created that is not there in the world before technology was there. And so he says if we use technology the right way, we can create a kind of new a platform for something that hasn't been possible up to now. And that in face-to-face situations you may create something together, but to have it in the long run, and this idea of having something created by man himself and not just one man is the whole philosophy. I mean, this is a religion.
That's a really wonderful quote, and it really does undergird, I think, Stallman's and the free software philosophy. Software isn't a competition. It's something that everyone can be creating and learning from the algorithms and the clever programming tricks that others have put into practice.
Yeah. And artists are not, I think, mainly interested in technology for the sake of technology itself, but they are interested in what technology does to the social structures, to the people, to our capacities of experiencing. Something that is sometimes forgot, I think, in the fixation on progress and on development for future commercial uses. And so they always try to derivate it a little bit and bring it into other connections. And basically what the question came from, what would Bill Gates do? I think behind this idea of openness on the one side, in the artistic and in the programming sense, and on closeness in commercial and also in philosophical and artistic senses, there are two different societal models. But this will go too far if we discuss that. But basically, it's a two different society models.
Let's just
sure about that.
Let's go back. I'd like to do a little bit of contrast, since we've compared the similarities of these very quickly. In thinking about the issue, struck me that a couple things that in some ways the artwork, the open artwork, so-called, is more closed.
than these technological models. In some ways, it's more open. It's more closed in that it tends to maintain authorship more than open source does. You know, we still talk about John Cage. We talk about Nam June Paik. We don't forget the originator of the code. We've talked about Richard Stallman, not because necessarily every program, well, he definitely didn't write every, you know, copylefted program, but because he came up with the idea. We cannot possibly document all of the people who've contributed to copylefted software. However, on the other side, the open artwork can sometimes eliminate the boundary between audience and participant, as in the Valley Export happening and other, you know, Alan Caprow happening, so forth, that Dieter alluded to. Whereas the user base of an open source project, as the people actually use the email program or whatever it is usually much bigger than the people actually coded. So that's one place where maybe the art tends to be a little more open than the software community. The user base is the same as the participants. But let's backtrack quickly just to hit one point here. There's a lot of utopian talk on email listservs and so on about open source and open licenses. Wendy, have these really succeeded in offering an alternative to the, you know, click wrap licenses and copyrighted content that's everywhere else?
Open source software is at a lot of the foundation points of the internet. So I do think so. While you don't see Linux on the desktop of every office you walk into, it is in a lot of the internet name servers, in the mail servers, a majority of the web servers are still running Apache, which is an open source program.
So it's sort of behind the scenes, even if it doesn't, you know, have the little trademark Microsoft emblem when you start up the machine.
That's right. So you don't see it so often, but it's there, and it's there because it's configurable and because system administrators can massage it to meet the needs of the changing internet. I think its flexibility has allowed it to succeed there.
Okay. Thanks for answering that. I'm going to jump to a sort of slide into a different sense of openness that is often confused with the kind of openness we've been talking about now, and that's interactivity. I think, you know, Nam June Paik had the excellent phrasing of participation TV, the idea of participation. Well, in the 90s, at least in the art world, and to some extent in the world of e-commerce and so forth, that word became replaced with the word interactivity. And we all became excited about interactive art. The evolution of the open work culminated, in some sense, in this interactive design, whether it be for, you know, e-commerce sites online or interactive installations that you find in many museums these days. And I'm wondering, Dieter, if you think that this particular endpoint of the open trajectory is it a pinnacle or is it a dead end?
Well, I think it's two parallel tracks that started in the early 90s at the moment that technology became accessible for artists, digital technology in a more broader scope, that you could work as an artist with high tech without having to be part of a sponsored institution, you know. And one is the what you are indicating to, like a closed interactive system. Maybe we show that system, which was kind of fascinating at the time, like this work by Jeffrey Shaw, where you just have a bicycle as an interface, and as you travel along through a map which you have on this little monitor, you get through a city of letters. There's one New York version, for example, where each house is replaced by one letter, and you travel through New York with your bike, and that's kind of interactive in a sense.
This work was shown actually at the Guggenheim Soho in 1995.
Oh, yeah. So this is from 1991, or what is it? Yeah, I think so.
91.
And it is kind of interesting. People were kind of fascinated with that. It doesn't, you don't have to know much about technology. You just can sit on the bike and do whatever you do on the bike. So it's kind of popular in that sense. But considering the degree of openness and interaction is kind of limited because it needs a big 3D computer graphic engine at the time, which was kind of expensive, more expensive than the artwork would ever be on the market, which is kind of a paradox of creating an artwork on a computer is more expensive than the artwork would ever be. But okay, so and it was limited in the sense that it was all predefined. You couldn't change the map. It couldn't change the words, you know. So this was a kind of technology of interactivity that has come, I think, today maybe to a dead end, in a way. Would you agree about that, Alex? That this kind of straightforward 3D cyberspace interaction has kind of finished now, I think, somehow, you know. It doesn't offer too much opportunities. You don't get out of the labyrinth, you know.
Well, let me suggest, because I think it's... we need to define what that kind of interactivity is, and one of the best ways I think of defining it is by saying what it's not. It tends to be a limited set of options, whereas one of the original definitions of interactivity from MIT scientist Andy Lippmann way back in the 60s, I believe, had a fivefold kind of set of symptoms that something that was interactive had to have, and it's very different from these sort of experiences here. He said such a system had to be mutually interruptible, had to degrade gracefully. Now, what does that mean? Okay, mutually interruptible means if you stopped the system, it didn't keep going on its own. If it degraded gracefully, if something went wrong, the computer might say, "Excuse me while I, you know, fix something," rather than, you know, "Error 561, you know, fatal exception." Limited look ahead, meaning you couldn't see the whole thing at once. That is characteristic of Jeffrey Shaw's piece. No default. There was no, like, respond to you individually. It wouldn't give everyone the same set of choices. And finally, the impression of an infinite database, which is one of the things that I find most limited about a lot of the mm-hmm. interactive art you're referring to, where you only had like five buttons, and when you clicked on them, bells and whistles or videos or whatever played, but then that was it. You had explored all the options, and there was no more further else to go. What's interesting to me about this definition, very early definition, is it really doesn't sound like Bill Gates' vision of, you know, interactivity. It sounds like a conversation, like an email conversation. And the idea that, you know, an artwork could somehow respond to you in a human way or in a conversational, communal way.
Yeah. But I think that is exactly what is a project started at the same time at Jeffrey Shaw's work, which is coming from the other side. As I was saying, there are two tracks of interactivity used by artists who get access to technology. One would be this 3D experience, which tries to make interaction a physical experience, and which is interesting in the sense that the artwork is a creation of a new interface, which can even be adapted to kind of commercial use later on. But the interface is the artwork, so to say.
Right. But you mentioned the Steve Chase example.
Yeah, that comes later on, maybe. Okay. Yes. But the moment you kind of try to connect several people, at that time in the early 90s, you still had a problem. You wouldn't kind of have a 3D world where you could interact. So you had to go really back to basics, to text. And that was a project like The Thing, that was, because Wolfgang Stelle is among us. So I just would like to mention that in 1991, The Thing was started in New York in a very primitive stage. It looked like that, the interface. You know, so it was a network between different cities, between Cologne, New York, Paris, Vienna, what else? Berlin for a while, Switzerland, it was Amsterdam, was very active, yeah? All raised from local kind of initiatives to make a kind of discourse network about what is happening in the art world. On a technology that was kind of pre-internet in the sense that it was self-constructed network technology, which you could access through your phone line, and it was not connected to the rest of the net. It was a standalone network system where at night, when the rates were low, the information was exchanged across the Atlantic, as far as I remember. And that only later on had a gateway to the internet. So again, artists were kind of developers or hackers or amateurs, as I showed the example before, to develop a new way of communication. And what we see now, I think, if we have avatars or 3D work on the net, is a convergence of these two possibilities of interactivity. You have now smarter interfaces on the web, where the interface is also part of the artwork, and you still have a communicative structure within. So these two tracks that were starting in the early 90s are getting together now, and that in the future maybe you have some possibility of having physical, communicative, and connective experiences, you know. So people talk about that like cyber sex, so maybe something that the ultimate.
I just want to bring up, I don't know if you can see this image, but if, the thing in its an original version, as Dieter said, was not connected to the internet. It was sort of a hand-constructed network, if you will, and this is from the Guggenheim Cyber Atlas site. But
people, the first experience of being online at home, you know, it was the first possibility you had email at home when still email was only accessible in institutions. Imagine, you had to go to university to have email. You couldn't check it at home at night. You mean, that's incredible today.
Right.
That might be a good thing at times.
Okay, so we come back to that, Wolfgang. We relaunch it now.
Right. In the interest of time, I think there were some dystopian examples of this, but I think we should jump to, in essence, the world post-thing, if you will, and the world once the internet became a lively space for artists and programmers and so forth to be creative. As we know, artists were online from the very beginning, the thing being a good example, but also the statistics I always mention is, in 1995, 8% of all websites were created by artists. That is an astounding figure.
How many percent?
8%. It's like, imagine you walk down a city block and every, you know, one out of every 10 storefronts is an artist studio.
Uh-huh.
Unimaginable. So, what sort of vision have these artists brought? Where have they come with this open paradigm? I think what we like to do is maybe take a look, Alex, if you want to steer me in the direction of some projects that have this kind of openness. And again, in the background here again is this question of, are these projects that are served or harmed by intellectual property? Intellectual property law assumes that artists and other creators need financial incentives to create truly innovative work. Well, as we know, the original internet was a place where people put things for financial gain. Programmers sent off code into the ether. Academics wrote papers back and forth. Physicists exchanged data. And artists were out there making websites. Did the lack of a market-driven incentive for this kind of work stunt the level of creativity that we see in online art? Or has openness somehow encouraged intervention in this way? And Alex, if you want to go through some examples, I'll be happy to steer.
Do you want to start with desktop?
Desktop,
yeah.
Okay. There are a lot of examples of NetArt projects that sort of embody this sense of openness generally, and then specifically this sense of, interactivity or the idea of an artwork being generative, that is, sort of allowing for an unexpected or unpredictable set of possible outcomes to happen. So this is a piece, I don't really remember when this is from, maybe 1997, 1998 in there, or maybe it's dated, from a Russian artist, Alexei Shulgin, called Desktop Is. And it's a very simple idea. Actually, if you want to go to the bottom one, it's a very simple concept. What you do is you take a snapshot, a screenshot of your computer desktop, and then you email it to Alexei, and he puts it up on this website. So it's a sort of group exhibition in process, right? And it also involved a kind of social interaction where the desktop is idea, was circulated out on various email lists, and so people would kind of be sort of checking in on these names that they only knew through email, and now, wow, they get a sort of glimpse into what their computer desktop looks like. And so then all of a sudden that became a very, albeit maybe primitive or limited, but a very simple way of doing personal expression. So you have here from Rachel Baker, the one with the gray background, this sort of simple narrative that's created using just the folder names and the file names. Baker sexuality protected by virus drop scan. Or the circular narrative in the center. So it's sort of, this is not to say that using the iconography of a desktop is a revolutionary aesthetic or genre by any means, but it's sort of meant to highlight the fact that
it uses the idea of just normal community online to create a kind of interactive group activity, right? And then I can just mention a sort of very interesting afterthought, almost more of a development, I would say, is this project called Desk Swap, which maybe you can just show the, I don't know if you have the website up, but.
Oh, I didn't actually.
We're not going to show it in action, but it's it basically takes the same idea and it makes it actually instantaneous and real. So it's a screensaver. And what happens is when you leave your computer and walk away and the screensaver launches, it actually takes a snapshot of your desktop at that moment and then swaps that image with someone else around the world who's also running the same screensaver at that moment. So you come back to your computer and it's, you know, all of a sudden a Macintosh with all different color icons and maybe a different language.
Pornographic images.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's,
their friends.
It's not an interactive desktop by any means. It's, you know, you haven't sort of simulated that person's computer. It's just a static image. But it's still, you know, you have this bizarre window. And you know that yours is, that whoever you're looking at is also looking at you, too.
In order to get into that group, you have to share your desktop.
You have to give something
away.
And there was another. I mean, I think actually Mark Napier did another project, if I remember correctly, that had to do with desktops. I may be remembering that incorrectly, but it's definitely something that has been kind of evocative for artists who work with computers.
Somewhat. I mean, Riot. We could look at Riot or Shred.
Yeah, we can look. I mean, we can look at some
take
of
a look
other
at,
work now too.
At one of them. this is now Mark Napier's work. Shredder and who has a favorite website to shred? What, Disney? So this is a project. I mean, I don't know, Alex. You want to?
This is a. Basically, an artistic interface that you give it a web address, and what it does is instead of showing you that web page in its sort of normal conventional way that Netscape would show it or Internet Explorer would show it, what it does is it interprets that web page in a very different way, which is obviously its prerogative if it wants to do that. There's no necessarily set interpretation of HTML. So this is an example of the Guggenheim website shredded. So the code is, as you see, foregrounded. The font is increased greatly or reduced. The images are repeated, or the width and height of the images are sort of distorted and stretched. So the idea is that, you know, you have these systems, web pages, which have these limitations on them, and, you know, how can we maybe open up that and figure out other ways to interpret the same data? So that's also an example of kind of opening up the system, and also being interactive in the sense that it's the user themselves, the person who visits the shredder and types in the web address, who gets to create that outcome.
It's creating kind of abstract random work, so it's completely in the open artwork tradition in a way. Only machine does it now.
And it's definitely like the participation TV models for the composition of music.
Only it's more subversive, you know, more deconstructive, so to say.
Do you want to look at
copyright
Riot?
Lawyer might ask whether that was a derivative work of the website.
Yeah, no kidding.
You were looking
look at Riot as an example of something that is also by Mark Napier, but is more interactive in the communal sense. This is sort of an extension of the earlier piece, Shredder, but instead of having just one person browsing on one site, it allows a number of people to collectively shred several different things onto one browser. So it's called Riot because it sort of simulates, you know, what would a riot actually be like on the web if you had many different people kind of interacting in this sort of chaotic way. So you see here, these are, I think I forget, I think maybe the last four web pages, three? Are mixed on there. So if you go and type in Guggenheim, it becomes the new kind of fodder, and the third one down on the list gets bumped off It's always changing.
One of the neatest things is the links are preserved, so you can actually like still click through the Guggenheim's website, but you'll, you know, sort of just add. Oh, this is the Whitney? Let's click on the Guggenheim some more.
No.
So obviously, they also disarm the institutional hold on art and as a container for individual self-contained artworks, but that's for today. Many other examples of a great like area for creative work is gaming. So there are a lot of artists who take commercially available gaming platforms, you know, things like Quake or Half-Life, and introduce bugs or introduce modifications into those systems and create radically different experiences. We won't really show any of that work right now, but it's important to highlight. So how about works like this? Okay, we've got these what sometimes have been called collider works. Maybe it's a subset of this, but in general, they draw from the fact that the internet exists. They're not self-contained. They mine data from everywhere. They sometimes involve uniting people from different disparate regions or ideologies into communities. What's the legal ramification of this? I mean. You know, what would the law say about this?
The law is just beginning to think about this. Not so much yet, it hasn't yet reached the artworks, but sites that frame other sites. Sometimes you'll see banner ads from one site popping up on top while you find other content underneath. And that Total News was an early site that would do this, put all of its own banner ads around the edges, and then call up the New York Times or CNN in the middle, so that and a large group of newspapers and news sources sued, saying Total News was unfairly trading off their proprietary content, their trademarks, their copyrighted works, and misappropriating their efforts for its own ends, and that case settled, but so we don't yet have a lot of legal precedent. A more recent image search engine would go, the Ariba search engine trolled the web looking for images. Most search engines at the time allowed you to type in text and pull up pages that had those keywords. The Ariba engine, now at Ditto.com, would allow you to search for images. You typed in Gold Rush and you'd get a group of pictures that people had labeled with those terms. An artist, Leslie Kelly, sued Ariba saying it was unfairly copying his images, taking his copyrighted works and putting them into its database as it had to in order to perform this function. And the court there recently sort of split the difference on that case, saying that taking the works into the database was a fair use, that creating a database that collected images and allowed you to look at them in a new way was transformative of the images. Instead of being separate images on a group of separate web pages, they were now a trove, an archive of information that could be mined by people looking for specific terms or specific genres of image. But the court there said that the site couldn't then take the image and display it under Ariba's banners out of the context of the original website. When you found an image you wanted, you could see the thumbnail, but if you wanted the full-size image, it had to take you to Leslie Kelly's site to see the image in the context that he had put it into, and that way be returning you to Kelly's vision of this image on the web.
Well, what about, let's take Leslie Kelly's side for a minute. Shouldn't artists be, you know, rewarded for their efforts? Why do we have a problem with copyright in cases like this? Isn't the goal of copyright to prevent people's work from being used for other commercial purposes?
That's it's an interesting case, and some people think that that has struck the right balance, that by giving him the right to control some of the display there, other people argue that his server is in fact making the images available to everyone. It's not, the Ariba server isn't doing anything different or anything that's disallowed by the technology when it asks for only the image instead of the image and its web page. So because his server is willing to give up the image, shouldn't anyone else be allowed to link to that image individually?
Well, this brings up then the sort of looking back on the sort of variety of things that you've seen here, I think it's clear that both these projects complicate the matters for judges trying to figure out whether these things are fair use or not. But they also demonstrate a fair amount of richness, of vibrancy that happened pretty much outside of market-driven forces. There weren't incentives. We should start by saying that, you know, the predominant of internet artists don't make any kind of living off their work. They post things the same reason that coders posted things and academics posted things in the early internet to become part of this community. And I think sometimes we lose perspective on painters and sculptors. Most painters and sculptors don't make a living off of their work. They labor in their own studios. But let's leave that economic question for a little bit later and sort of put these two pieces together. We have the artists working in this open way. We have the law with the aid of certain regulatory technologies working to, over the time, the trajectory is always to close down the technology. So we had radio that began in a very open-ended way, becoming closed broadcast model. We had television that, you know, had potential that now is usurped or co-opted by cable TV and so on. We see that potential for the internet. I'd like to review some art projects that are ways that artists have reacted to this, the threat of enclosure, and then we can judge whether really there has been any success or whether in fact they've been sort of, you know, just feeble attempts to stop this unstoppable juggernaut. One of the very earliest is Antoni Montadas' File Room, which I have in here. This was originally a version that was offline. It was literally, as you see in this picture, a bunch of metal file cabinets in a room, each of which documented instances of censorship. Now, the goal of the installation was, in a way, a very early open source project. People would describe their own cases of censorship, either ones that they had experienced directly or had heard about. They didn't need to be Eldred versus Reno, some Supreme Court case. They could just be, I was not allowed to speak at the PTA, you know, in my local Des Moines, Iowa high school. That's one of the premises of open source. It's sort of like everyone gets a shot at it. It's not filtered by some centralized authority. In this case, there is a centralized depository, but it is now online. And one of the most interesting ways to go into it is the archive of cases is to choose an interface. Okay, these are the different ways you can access it by date. That is when the case of censorship happened. Of course, it goes back to Galileo being told by the Pope that he wasn't allowed to tell people that, you know, the sun doesn't revolve around the earth. By location, where it took place. By medium, from painting to photography to print. And one of the most interesting ones is grounds for censorship. Was it about, you know, being sexy? Was it the language used? Nudity, which is not necessarily the same as sex. Was it political, economic, social opinion, racial censorship, religious censorship, and so on. And when you go look at, let's look at nudity. You find a lot. You know, there's one at the Jersey City Museum. There's the Illinois one, Oscar with Chicken. I have no idea what that is. But, you know, there is the artist, there's the confronting bodies, there's the date of the action, and there's the location. It describes everything. And, you know, clearly this is input by someone from their own computer. In a way, it becomes an open archive to combat something that is inherently impossible to combat from a centralized system, because you know, centralization tends to meet centralized decision making. Well, how do you create an archive of censorship when any kind of filtering is equivalent to censorship? Answer, you leave it open to the public to make the decisions themselves. This has a much more dynamic analog, I think, in the contemporary gallery of CSS descramblers, which has probably the most unappealing title of any of the projects you'll see today. But you notice that there's this little sort of thumbnail that looks like a gallery in the corner, and it is really an attempt to be an art gallery, although written in the, you know, legalese and computerese. This is a project by a computer scientist at CMU called Dave Tretzky. And Wendy probably knows more about this than I do, but I ran into his project because I'd heard about people using illegal code to make artworks. And Wendy, if you want to tell us why that code could possibly be illegal.
This gallery is various representations of the DCSS code. DCSS is the code that decrypts CSS protection on DVD movies. And in a recent court case here in New York, 2600 Magazine had posted DCSS code on its website in the course of telling people about the encryption on DVD movies and the fact that the studios had now made it so they couldn't take excerpts from the movies they were watching, or even to watch a DVD on a computer running Linux. 2600 was brought to court by the movie studios and enjoined from posting the code or even from linking to DCSS. They were told, this is an illegal circumvention device because it breaks the encryption that the copyright holders are using to protect their movies. The code is declared illegal and 2600 may not post or link to it. In reaction to that court case and to the hubbub around DCSS code, various artists and programmers from around the net put together other implementations of DCSS to ask the question, isn't code speech? Some of these are algorithms that look very complex and are just a mass of symbols that few but experienced computer programmers would understand. Some of these are textual descriptions of the way the decryption code works. Some of them are stories in which the encryption key becomes the protagonist and is interacting with the movie. Some of them are, as we see up here, slides in which the code parades past, like the opening to a Star Wars movie. And artists and computer scientists have put these up to ask, aren't we restricting speech? The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law restricting the freedom of speech and of the press. Isn't enjoining this code a restriction of speech and of the press?
I'm just picking a couple things out of the ensemble here, but as Wendy said, it's an incredible variety. This is the DVD logo built with the illegal code. That is the logo of the organization that made this code illegal. There is also a haiku, which I can't help but quote from as soon as I find it. It's phenomenal. It's actually very hard to find on this thing.
Right about there, yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. How to decrypt a DVD in haiku form. You know, and it goes on, and it's, you know, of course, in haiku. Now, haiku, of course, is a literary genre, one that we usually associate with speech. You know, this goes back to, what's his name, Ariel Pagetica and, who's that?
Milton,
thank you. Okay, so, you know, the very earliest sort of proposals for free speech come out of literature. Well, here is a literary version of a code, and it tells you everything you need to do to write the code that decrypts the DVD. So it functions exactly like the computer code, yet it is in a genre that we all associate with, you know, protection, free speech protection. There's also, one of my favorites is there's of course the t-shirt and tie, which you can get, which of course is not executable, but all you have to do is write down what's on the t-shirt and you could decrypt the DVD and copy it for yourself. There is, one of my favorites is a program written in a hypothetical computer language, a fictional computer language that does not yet exist, meaning that it is useless now and hence perfectly legal, but if someone ever wrote a compiler for it, then it would be suddenly illegal. So what Turetsky did was to invite artists and crazy people to create this huge smorgasbord of versions of this illegal code to prove that you could not draw a line between code on one side and speech on the other. And although the court didn't overturn the illegality of the code, it did recognize as part of Turetsky's testimony that the code was speech, in essence, and that you couldn't distinguish them, and hence the judgment by an original judge that Turetsky was reacting to was wrong. This is one of the few cases where I know an artwork or an ensemble of artworks proved a court case. You know, that these are not simply executable, to use a term that Jolene Blaise applied to this. They're not simply executable in the sense of computer programs. They're executable by the U.S. legal system. They serve a function that's not simply like, you know, Guernica or Wrath of the Medusa to call attention to a political problem. They actually solve a political problem, or at least help to. And that's a pretty bizarre thing to do, but it's something that is an attempt to, in essence, fight back against the enclosure of what people see as free speech. I'll give you one more example. This is a project by a group with the impossible to pronounce website 01001011010110101.org. There are a bunch of Italian programmers who remain anonymous. They create websites where they are what you might call experts of the computer cache. Now, cache is that place in the computer that automatically makes like copies of websites when you go to them. And of course, this is what has artists and the Recording Industry of America and the Motion Picture Association of America totally frantic about the internet, because in order to simply view something, you make a copy. You know, when you go to a website, we have the illusion that you visit it, you travel to it. No, you don't. You bring it to you. And the copy that you look at on your screen is not the copy at the distant server, it's a copy sitting on your hard drive in the cache. So what these people do is they sort of, you know, cache for a living, or for an artistic livelihood anyway. And there was a very interesting situation that happened thanks to Rhizome, where a group of artists who felt that it would be interesting to experiment with a closed system online created something called Hell.com. And Hell.com was a series of artworks that could not be accessed directly. You had to have a password to get in. Well, this is the exact contrary to all the things you've seen so far, the emphasis being on openness, on access, on everybody being able to see everyone else's website. Hell.com had, however, periodic viewings. And at one point, they allowed members of the Rhizome online community, which were notified via an email list, access for 24-hour period to all the projects on the site. Now, if you went to the site without the password, without the secret URL, what you saw was a page very much like this. It was sort of a black screen, and it said answers possibly in sometime, something like that. And when you clicked on it, you got a series of messages that said things like, what is this? And then there was an answer, and the answer said, a private parallel web. And then you'd say, the question would say, how do I get in? And the answer would be, you can't. And the question would say, like, who do I have to know? And they would say, you know, it doesn't matter, you can't get in. And say, the questions got very pointed at one point. They would say things like, you know, well, isn't the web about, you know, access? And the answer would be, well, I wouldn't let you in my living room. And it was this very kind of contrary stance, as artists are wont to take, to the prevailing notion of the web as an open space. Well, they made a bit of a mistake in whatever year it was that they let Rhizome at it for 24 hours, because the artists of 001.org took those 24 hours and cached
everything, the entire site. And they put it up on their own website with one small change. They changed the opening interface, which is what you see here, so that if you clicked on answers, instead of it said, what is a private parallel web? And the answer was, a virtual world comprised of numerous sites that are accessible to everybody. Well, before that it said, accessible to a private few. So the only things they changed were the political content of the opening screens that, were basically the guard dog putting people away and discouraging them and tantalizing them with the notion of a private parallel web. And if you click through this, it's all the same. How can I get in? Access is granted to everybody. Not, you can't. How can I get a membership? You don't need it. How can I get invited? You are welcome. What does that mean? You don't need to be invited. No effort on your part is required. I just want to take a peek. Enjoy yourself. Can I pay for a membership? No. But my friend said they couldn't get in. They lied. What does that mean? Occasionally we change our location. How can I be a guest? Please understand you don't need any fucking permission. So the point was that they turned what was a closed system via the open protocols of the internet into a closed one. And of course they drew the fire and ire of the people who created the first net. But it was a wonderful example of the art world attempting to, at some corner, close itself and the openness of the internet protocols opening it back up again. There are many other examples of projects that are fascinating along these lines, but I think that gives you a sense of the direction some of them taken. Alex, you wanted to focus on a couple of them, Toy War and then a project that you've created.
Seems a carnival one.
There was a question? Yes, in the back.
A lot of the features that you're showing are features that have been internet sites use specifically for promotion, for one-off community, what artists are doing, and they, to tweak some of the features. And I guess my question, I'm looking at some of the examples you gave, the some sites and open art examples, and comparing it to what's happening today. And it's great to be a lawyer on the channel, but with intellectual property becoming so fluid and in many ways intangible, and with so many questions being raised as far as code and speech, and in worlds where intellectual property and patents and everything is becoming monetized, where is the artist in this? It's kind of committed to the team now. Would he be creating the kind of work that he created? I think the answer today, there's something more profound in that than the examples that I used to share. Maybe it's the collective, the collaboration that takes place between people. But this sort of environment that we are in today, it's great to talk about the web, but there's so many other technologies being used. And
specifically about whether the whether we have in some way perhaps biased the selection toward the technologies that are easier to keep open, whereas there are other forms of expression or other arenas of society where the monetary interests are overwhelming or could overwhelm artistic expression. Is that a fair summary?
One is about the medium
is
discussed, and the other is just one general question.
I think the
juxtaposition of examples, there's a big leap for me in these examples, and I'm trying
to... Leap from which examples to which?
The examples that you gave, even up to, for example, the work that I've seen that was done in the 90s, I think something happened with the boom of the internet and with the monetization and the focus on intellectual property and how that has impacted the work of artists who use technology, not just web-based technology, but other kinds of technology.
Okay, so specifically the economic boom and how that climate has changed things. I'd like to bracket that question because I think we will revisit it. We'll look at a couple other examples of artistic projects that may or may not speak to that. And then when we look at some of the sort of new proposals for ensuring open access
legally that Wendy has described, which have economic ramifications, then we will be in a better position to examine that. So let's jump to... if you don't mind, I'd like to hold off until we get to the through these other examples, because I think they'll help shed light on the question. Do you want to go into Toy War then?
Sure.
Okay. We can actually just show that
right
window quickly. And again. So, as I mentioned earlier, this dispute between eToy and eToys, the artist group on the one hand and the online toy retailer on the other hand, I want to just bring this up again to highlight, this right here you see is quite literally a timeline that shows the valuation on the NASDAQ of eToys.com versus the sort of semi-hypothetical valuation of the artist collective. That's part of their aesthetic. They operate as a corporation. They sell stock. And so you can see that the blue line of the graph represents the toy retailer, and the white line represents the art group. And so this is a sort of a representation that they created of, you know, how the sort of cultural capital, if you will, of the two organizations changed during the Toy War. And I mentioned that earlier, the Toy War being this online participatory game that you could play. So when eToy got sued, they said, well, you know, we have to battle this in court, but we also want to battle this sort of in the court of public opinion, quite literally. So we want to say that, you know, anyone who wants to get involved in this can be a soldier in the Toy War. So it was an actual video game that you could play online. You would get a sort of avatar, like you see here, these little Lego figures. There were different battlefields that were sort of virtually in different cities around the globe. You could travel from city to city. It had its own internal monetary system, its own internal email system. You could do things like send media bombs, which were these sort of letters of appeal to different media outlets to help publicize the event. So this Toy War, which they also, by the way, the art group claims that it's the most expensive art performance ever in history. Because at the end, if you want to scroll to the right, you see that eventually, this also very coincidentally coincided with the burst of the internet bubble. So at the end, you see that eToy stock price was driven so far down that they eventually had to declare bankruptcy and go out of business. So eToy kind of describes this process of destroying capital on a stock market as a type of performance art, and in essence was the most expensive performance art in history. So that's just another example of this kind of open system that allows people to participate on. And maybe if we have time, I can show Carnivore really quickly.
Yeah, please do.
Can we toggle over to this monitor? So I want to talk about, just briefly describe a project that I'm involved with called Carnivore. Some of you may be familiar with Carnivore from the news. It's a piece of software that the FBI developed and employs to whenever they need to do an electronic wiretap. If there's a court order saying that they can do surveillance on a suspect, they, you know, can tap that person's phone, but they can also, their phone.
I don't seem to be getting through to Sony. Do you have the
that's
yeah.
To hear that thing?
There it is. Okay. Good.
So if there's a court order, the FBI can tap a person's phone. But they developed a way to also tap the person's email, and this has also been in the courts. They've since been changed the name. There was a lot of sort of controversy in Congress that the name Carnivore was too sort of offensive to the public, and it makes sense. So now it's called DCS 1000. So in this,
the idea that wouldn't arouse the ravenous press.
So in the spirit of sort of taking a closed technology and making it open, taking something that's private, or in this case, private to the government, and making it public, I gathered a group of artists to, in essence, clone
the Carnivore software and turn it into an art project. So make our own version of it that does the similar things, release it under an open source license to the general public into the public domain. And so that's what this project is, hence the name Carnivore. This is just a sort of informational web page on the project.
I mean, they're really nice to look at. So
if you look at this diagram here, you can sort of see how Carnivore works. What it does is it performs, quite literally, an act of data surveillance in whatever room or whatever building that it's in. It listens to all the data traffic, all the emails, all the people surfing the web, all the instant messages, all the FTP sessions, all the telnet sessions, 100%. And you see that sort of diagram of how Carnivore has a 100% invasive ability to invade into a data network. And then what it does is a sort of data stream, quite literally a raw data stream, which is unappealing to look at for most people. So what the software does is it sends it out to any number of artistic clients, clients just being the receiving end, and turns it into a sort of audio-visual experience. And I'll show you an example of one of the pieces right now. I guess Mark Napier is the sort of net artist of choice tonight, and he created a carnivore client, which visualizes the data stream. So this is the simulation, but if it were running right here in this museum, you know, if someone upstairs sends an email, it would be written on this screen right here. This piece is called Black and White, and you see up on the top, it's keeping track of, you know, how all computer data at its core is ones and zeros, right? So it's actually keeping track of which side is winning in order to, so you see the zeros versus the ones, in order to derive a sort of overall percentage of, you know, what data looks like, you know, from the most kind of abstract, far away perspective. And if you let this piece run, it creates a sort of turbulent cloud formation filled with white and black lines. And what's interesting is that if you let it run for 2 days and then stop and let it run again for 2 days, it creates a very similar shape every time. There's this sort of essential shape of data as he's created it using this interface. The possibilities are sort of endless with this project. It's meant to be an open platform for collaboration. So, for example, a different artist using the exact same type of core data created a very different interface. This is by an artist named Josh Davis from the site Prey Station. And this interface is also a visualization of the hidden data, the data that's normally hidden. But it visualizes it more like a map, where every circle is an actual computer that is talking at any given moment. And then the colors are created by what type of communication is happening. So the blue are people surfing the web. The green is people sending email, and so on. So these are just examples of how two different artists can use this platform, which is Carnivore, to create very, very different things. We have another artist who created a three-dimensional virtual reality world that you can actually fly through. So the possibilities are really endless.
Let's jump to now the kind of the bottom line here, which is, we've seen, as the audience member discussed, these sort of utopian openness on online art. And for a while, it wasn't, you know, really before the artists, or at least simultaneous with them, it was popular for hackers to espouse what they called crypto anarchy, which meant with encryption and with the, you know, open protocols of the internet, the wild frontier would never be regulatable. Wendy, is that realistic?
In a word, no. The lawmakers and politicians and ordinary people using the internet see things that are clear, that are against the law offline, and want to stop that happening online as well. And some of it's sort of creeping that there will be initial problems that everyone agrees. We don't want to see child pornography online. So because we can regulate that, we must do that. And then groups will pick up on their own pet interests and feel that it's necessary to regulate, whether it's digital copying or certain kinds of speech that they find offensive, sites promoting violence to children. And basically, the technology doesn't demand openness. It's there, and through laws or through alternate technologies, it can be closed off.
So what can you do within the existing intellectual property system to solve this? What can artists do to keep an openness that they have come to, you know, feel as part of the livelihood that they live by?
Well, one of the projects that we started at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society is the Open Law Project that tries to bring the public back into the debate over intellectual property. Intellectual property was initially conceived as a balance between the private interest of the creator and the public domain. It was to encourage creation so that the public would benefit. And through the course of legislation, the public side has been shrunk because the public isn't part of many of the debates over copyright protection. Most recently, the Copyright Term Extension Act added another 20 years to all existing copyrights. And at the Berkman Center, on behalf of Eric Eldred, an internet publisher, and various other plaintiffs, the church choir that wanted to use works that would have become part of the public domain but for this copyright extension, brought suit challenging the act as how can giving an extra 20 years to a dead artist or author promote additional innovation?
good question. So
Robert Frost just isn't writing any more poems, no matter how much copyright we had.
So open law is an experiment in this kind of getting interaction and comments from the public and from other people. So for example, if an artist wanted to say, well, you know, here's what it's like for me as an artist who, for example, I know a filmmaker who wanted to create a work that derived from his own cinematography. He worked in commercial studios and shot well-known films like The Piano and so forth, and he had the DVDs and he wanted to create a work that was in essence already drawing on his own film work, but just pulled from different DVDs, and he wasn't able to
because
of this.
He didn't own the copyright.
If he wanted to, and he couldn't copy the DVD, so if he wanted to, he could come here and he could essentially give you anecdotal evidence to support or even argumentative.
That's right. Open law is inviting the public to participate in the legal argument. It's saying this isn't just a question that should be decided by lawyers in a closed courtroom, but we should hear from the public, and specifically we should hear from the artists who are affected and the public who is reading and writing these works, how the public domain is important, and we've invited them through a series of discussion forums to pick apart the arguments that we've made, the arguments that the government has made in response, because this was a lawsuit where we sued the government for a judgment that the copyright term extension violated the Constitution. And the announcement in the middle of that page, CERF granted, the Supreme Court just recently agreed to hear the case. Meaning that the highest court in the land will be deciding whether the extension of copyright was constitutional.
Let's jump to a different situation. Okay, so that's you're an artist and you want to have an impact on the law in perhaps in the abstract. What if you're an artist who's directly affected by lawyers? For example, let's imagine an artist X
because I think Mark Nager's gotten too much airtime today. Artist X creates a series of projects based on distorted Barbies. And he receives then in the mail a cease and desist letter, which Artist X did, from Mattel, that you are sullying our trademark, et cetera, et cetera. What does Artist X do about that?
Well, that leads into another project that I just recently launched, the chillingeffects.org website, which is particularly concerned that these cease and desist letters don't always faithfully represent the law. They don't say to the artist, we believe what you're doing is a copyright infringement, but you might have a fair use defense, and in fact, your site is probably transforming those images so far that you would be free and clear of copyright law. Instead, the letter says, in no uncertain terms, you are violating our copyright, diluting our famous trademarks. Cease and desist at once. This website is a collaboration among law schools at Harvard, Stanford, Berkeley, University of San Francisco, and we're adding new partners as we speak, to analyze the claims in those letters and to give people real information about what those legal terms mean, to help explain what a copyright infringement is as versus a fair use, which copyright law specifically permits.
I'm going to just do a search on Mattel Barbie in here. Yes. Oh, look at that. okay, so Artist X looks,
comes to this website.
Right, and does a search on, you know, the issue, in this case, Mattel and Barbie. It mentions topic areas. There is an article. There are questions and answers. There are news stories about it. But I noticed that there are no C&D, that is cease and desist notices. So no one to date has put a letter from Mattel, a literal letter, you know, verbatim from the lawyers, on the site. What does that artist do now? To basically learn something from, you know, navigating the other links, but now they want to share that with other people. You still have it? Okay, so what do we do with it?
So part of the project here is to collect a database showing what's happening in the realm of cease and desist letters, and up on top among the options, a report receiving a cease and desist notice. We invite people who have received these letters to give them to us to add to our collection of and our research base of what's happening here, who is being chilled from speaking by lawyers' letters, and we invite them to categorize activities to help us figure out where in the site it'll fit.
Okay. So let's say I think it's parody or criticism. That's how I'm going to refer to it. So I'm going to click on that section. I see that I can fill out the date of the notice and information about it and the body of the letter and so on. And in theory, this could become part of the archive and a letter that could be referred to by other people. And I think
that's right. And what happens next is once the letter is submitted, law students in the various schools go through it and pull out these legal terms, the jargon, the claims that are being made and annotate it.
So explain what's going on. I just pulled up a sample letter. Explain what's going on in this letter.
This is a letter Sony sent a cease and desist letter to a programmer who had taught his robot dog to dance. The Aibo dog robot Sony sells can be programmed to do various activities. This programmer had, Sony claims, circumvented Sony's copy protection in order to give his dog more activity. In order to let his dog be a dancer, to make art from it, Sony claims